but you can imagine applying it in any other direction. The power of that method, or the power of that technique of directionally encoding diffusion, is that you can measure diffusion anisotropy. You can measure the directional dependence of diffusion in organized tissue, such as brain tissue or heart tissue. So that brings us to this point, which is that the motivation for diffusion tensor imaging is that in cerebral white matter, the diffusion is strongly anisotropic, typically a factor of 10 to 1. In the heart, which is probably of more interest for electrical impedance tomography, the conductivity anisotropy can also be high, but more typically on the order of 4 to 1. And this makes sense because the whole biophysical mission in life of white matter is to provide a conductive insulator. So the fact that it's anisotropic is not surprising in this context. But the point is that the effect of anisotropy has been systematically ignored in electromagnetic source imaging and to a lesser extent in electrical impedance tomography. So we wanted to develop a technique to measure the anisotropic effect, but also to gauge the significance of the anisotropy. So diffusion tensor imaging actually measures, it doesn't assume scalar diffusion, but rather it measures the complete diffusion tensor within each voxel. And so the diffusion tensor can be thought of as the covariance matrix for the diffusion Green's function. I should say here that there are a lot of MRI terms, so please, I hope you'll feel free to jump in if you have any questions. So here we have a diffusion tensor image taken horizontally, like such, parallel to the floor. And at every voxel location, I've simply rendered a small cylinder to depict the local diffusion tensor. So each cylindrical icon depicts the local tensor. So the axes of the cylinders are oriented in the direction of the eigenvectors and are scaled according to the eigenvalues. Oops, it's auto-advancing for some reason. I don't know why. So here you can see these white matter bundles that are actually... So the diffusion tensor provides an indication of the white matter orientation. So here you have these callosal fibers that project posteriorly, and here you have these nice U fibers. And I should say we've also color-coded the direction. So red is medial lateral, green is anterior posterior. And so this provides a kind of directional encoding for MRI. So as opposed to simple gray matter contrast, here we actually have a contrast mechanism that's based on the underlying orientation of the tissue. Here's some examples there. So the way that we want to relate this to the conductivity is to try to... It seems like a naive undertaking at the outset because diffusion tensor imaging measures the molecular mobility of the water molecules, whereas the conductivity is determined by the mobility, the diffusion mobility of the ions. So why should these two transport phenomena have any contact with each other? And the idea is that the diffusion tensor and the conductivity tensor are both functions of the underlying geometry of the tissue. So they both feel the same geometry for the boundary conditions. So if we can develop a model of how the diffusion tensor arises from the compartment microgeometry, and similarly a model of how the conductivity arises from the microgeometry, we can develop what's called a cross-property relation. And so this is something that has quite a bit of previous history in the context of material physics, where people are interested in measuring things like the thermal conductivity and trying to infer the electrical conductivity, or measuring the elastic stiffness tensor and trying to infer the thermal conductivity tensor. So it's in that vein that we tried to develop this cross-property relationship between the diffusion tensor and the conductivity tensor. So the framework we use is a technique called the contrast moment expansion, which was developed by the by Senence Turcato at Princeton. It's really just a wonderful, elegant formalism. I would encourage people to take a look at it if they're interested. But the basic principle of the contrast moment expansion is that we can describe a general transport tensor. So we can describe the diffusion tensor or the conductivity tensor in terms of the point statistics of the inclusions. So the idea is that if I can describe the point statistics of the inclusions in the medium, and I know the conductivity of the inclusions and the host medium, then I can derive the transport tensor of the effective homogenized medium. And so the reason that's very interesting is because I can say, well, the diffusion tensor is this function of the microgeometry, and the conductivity tensor is this function of the microgeometry. For most of the models, you can invert this function to obtain the microgeometry statistical expansion directly, and then equate it through the microgeometry, and so that you can say that the conductivity is a function of diffusion, but I don't need to actually invoke the actual geometry, so I can relate the conductivity and the diffusion independent of the actual boundary conditions of the tissue. And it sounds a little bit too good to be true, but I'll offer the following analogy. I mean, you can imagine if I have a cup of saline water, and I can measure the diffusion and the conductivity of this cup of salt water. And imagine I put in dielectric beads to reduce the conductivity. I could describe how as a function of concentration, and I can describe how the conductivity changes as a function of these beads, and then I can relate diffusion and conductivity through the concentration of the beads, where I've eliminated the concentration of the beads. And so that's an example where we've just used the zero order statistics, just the concentration. But then you can look at the higher order statistical moments of the point statistics of these inclusions in order to create this cross-property relationship. If anyone's interested in the mathematical details, I can refer them to that paper. So of course, there are a number of assumptions here. So some of them are weaker than others. So we assume that the tissue consists of two phases, so a host medium consisting of inclusions. And so we can think of this as the intracellular and extracellular space. We assume that each phase is individually isotropic, so that the intracellular phase is isotropic and the extracellular phase is isotropic. And it's only through the diffusion barrier, so the water or the ion diffusion barrier presented by the interface, that gives rise to anisotropy. We assume that the phases are in slow, fast exchange. So that there's fast transport between the two compartments. We assume no surface transport. And this is the assumption that's probably most relevant for the extension to EIT, which is that we're in the quasi-static regime. So for electromagnetic source imaging, where we're interested in neural currents, where most of the power is below a kilohertz, then this is a valid assumption. But this model can be extended to complex impedance, of course. And so for validation of this model, we can look at the Hoshine-Strickman bounds, which are some effective medium theory bounds on the effective transport. And we're also going to compare them to reported invasive conductivity measurements taken with electrodes. So that contrast moment expansion, when all of the dust settles, you can develop this relationship between the conductivity eigenvalue as a function of the water diffusion eigenvalues. And these terms are dependent only on the intracellular and extracellular diffusion, but there's no reference here to the actual boundary conditions. And then up to second order in the intracellular diffusion, the conductivity is linear in diffusion. And I should also say one of the aspects that pops out of this cross-property relationship is that the conductivity tensor and the diffusion tensor share eigenvectors, which is very intuitive. The idea that the relationship should somehow rotate the diffusion tensor just doesn't seem physically plausible on the face of it. So I'm going to skip this. Looking at increasing values of the intracellular to extracellular diffusion ratio. So here we have the ratio between the conductivity eigenvalue over the extracellular conductivity, and similarly the diffusion eigenvalue divided by the extracellular diffusivity. And so the dashed line represents the cross-property relationship, and the gray region represents the feasible region from the Hoshine-Strickman bounds, which is two-point effective medium bounds. And so the analytical relationship is given by this second order in intracellular diffusion approximation to the cross-property relationship. So there are a number of features of this model. So what we notice is that this predicts a very strong linear relationship between conductivity and diffusion. So even for high intracellular diffusion, you see this very strongly linear relationship between conductivity and diffusion. Another aspect is that at increasing intracellular diffusion, you affect the slope becomes more concave, and you also affect the intercept. So here we compared reported invasive conductivity measurements from electrodes collated over, I think, maybe half a dozen reported measurements in the literature. So these are invasive conductivity measurements that people have taken in a number of brain regions, in cerebellum, parasagittal cortex, motor cortex. And so we've simply collated those and compared those. And these come from animal experiments, but also from neurosurgical operations. And we've compared those conductivity measurements. So the y-axis is from the literature, and the x-axis is our diffusion measurements for four subjects in the corresponding anatomical regions. And we see, as predicted by the model, we see this strong linear relationship with a slope intercept at the diffusion axis. So we get an actual proportionality constant between diffusion and conductivity, and an estimate for the intercept, and it has a correlation coefficient of 0.945. So there's some nice features of this relationship. So it predicts a strongly linear relationship between diffusion and conductivity, and the conductivity persists even at zero diffusion. I'll skip these last 2 points, but the actual concavity of the conductivity relationship as a function of diffusion was not something we were able to confirm or disprove from these data, just simply because the data are rather limited. But it would be interesting to actually take some data from more detailed data to actually confirm that nonlinearity. So this allows you to actually obtain a voxel level image of the conductivity tensor at every voxel location. So here we have the optic radiation shown in these green series, and this is quantitative here, and I show the conductivity scale at bottom right. So one of the models that we're most interested in applying this in is in the rabbit model. This is in collaboration with the collaborators Jens Hauweisen and Daniel Gilmore at the Biomagnetic Center in Jena. So here we have a rabbit in the sagittal and axial view, where these little pink glyphs represent the conductivity or the diffusion tensor, which has been scaled to the conductivity tensor using the linear approximation at every voxel location. And here we have the corresponding, you can see the finite element mesh for the forward model. And so the stimulation was simply a medial nerve stimulation on the rabbit. I should say one of the reasons that an animal model is nice is because we can actually implant currents with electrodes, and then try to validate both the inverse solution and the forward model.
David, what does the mesh represent?
The mesh is just the discretization for the finite element solver.
For what submanifold is the mesh on?
It's a three-dimensional, I believe, octahedral mesh of the MR volume.
It's sitting in the brain, or it's sitting somewhere. What is it sitting at? What's the mesh on?
So there is the mesh includes both the skin, the scalp, the fluid space between the skull and the brain, and the actual brain itself. So it's a three-dimensional mesh that encompasses all of those tissue regions. Does that answer your question?
Okay,
it's not a surface mesh. It's a volumetric mesh of the MR volume. So inside of it is the conductivity tensor information. So this is a three-dimensional mesh of the MR volume, including both the structural data and the conductivity data.
And those are signal average somatosensory evoked potentials, aren't they?
Yeah. So right. So this. So what I'll show next is from medial nerve stimulation in tibial nerves.
How many averages would that be?
I don't know offhand. I can find out and let you know, but I don't know that much about the acquisition details for this particular experiment. So what we can do here is we can compare the isotropic inverse solution versus the anisotropic forward solution. So the color scale represents the current density from a linear inversion. So this is the continuous source distribution, and the pink arrow depicts the equivalent current source dipole. And what you notice is that when you include the anisotropic model, you see this roughly. I don't know the actual length scale here, but I believe this is roughly like a centimeter or 2 centimeter shift in the focus of the reconstructed current distribution. So the idea here is that when you include the actual estimate of the conductivity anisotropy, you significantly shift the reconstruction. So here for the tibial nerve stimulation, similarly, we see that the activity was shifted posteriorly in the for the source reconstruction, which shows that it's not just a displacement effect, but that the current reconstruction actually depends on the anatomical geometry. And so what's also neat about this is that if you compare, so if we focus on the left column, the medial versus tibial nerve stimulation for the isotropic model, there isn't a significant, the orientation of the effective current dipole changes, but the actual current source distribution doesn't change that significantly. Whereas with the anisotropic model, the focus of the equivalent of the current distribution changes much more significantly. So I think what this finding suggests is that when you include an anisotropic model for the forward model, you can you're adding additional structure to the forward solution that you can use to resolve. To resolve additional structure. So the idea is that for the isotropic model, there's little distinction between the two stimuli, whereas for the anisotropic model, you have greater differences in the reconstruction.
Compare those localizations to the actual brain maps, because it looked like they go in opposite directions as you'd expect. I don't know rabbit anatomy very well, but in human anatomy, you'd expect it the isotropic model goes.
So you would expect, in terms of, so the fact that it's shifting
is usually medial.
Right. So you would expect for the tibial nerve, for the tibial nerve stimulation to be further medial.
Closer to the.
Yeah. Let me check on that. So you're saying that this shift is actually more accurate of. I don't know the rabbit kind of somatosensory organization, but let me check on that actually. So, so in conclusion, we'll say that the conductivity tensor can be derived from the diffusion tensor with no assumptions on the microgeometry and relatively benign assumptions on the actual transport terms. So the effective medium model and the experimental comparisons both indicated a strong linear relationship between the conductivity and diffusion tensors. And in the experimental rabbit model, the conductivity anisotropy produced roughly a centimeter scale shift in the distributed source solution for the EEG. So we've talked mostly about the application in the context of electromagnetic source imaging, but I can say a few words about potential applications or extensions to EIT. So I think it would be very interesting to use the eigenvectors, given that there is still this ambiguity about how the eigenvalues scale, also for other brain regions. It would be interesting to use the eigenvectors as actual constraints, as rigid constraints for the EIT inversion, and then try to solve for the eigenvalues using the EIT. Another interesting application might be to use the conductivity trace conservation as a prior for the EIT inverse problem. This is a point I didn't mention, but we found that the trace of the diffusion tensor is strongly conserved throughout the brain, so this would provide a very strong prior for the EIT inversion. And lastly, now that we have an independent measurement of or estimate for the conductivity tensor, it would be interesting to cross-validate this with electroimpedance tomography. I'm not sure how I'm doing on time, actually.
Since you're the last speaker, you just wait
for
people to get up.
Okay, so. Okay, so this actually, so in investigating this relationship between transport and the actual microgeometry, this started us on an interesting project where we were interested in actually developing techniques to resolve the microgeometry from diffusion MRI. And we stumbled on something very interesting, which I'll just talk about very briefly as long as time permits. So what we noticed in a diffusion tensor image is that within the white matter bundles, within the sort of organized white matter bundles, you see strong anisotropy. But where the bundles actually meet and intersect, you see this decrease in anisotropy. So for example, here where these callosal fibers project posteriorly, in this region here where you have this intersection between different bundles, you see this decrease in the anisotropy. So you see here there's this sort of patch of low diffusion anisotropy. And the reason that is because the vector sum of the principal eigenvectors of the diffusion tensor, that vector sum is canceling out so that your effective diffusion tensor is more isotropic because of the orientational decoherence of the individual tensors. So this can just be explained schematically by this picture. So if I have one tensor component like such in a voxel from one fiber population and another tensor component like such from another fiber population, their tensor average is going to be reduced anisotropy. Simply, you know, if we say that the tensors are linearly. And you know, that prompted us to think, well, is it possible to develop a technique that can actually resolve the underlying orientational distribution? So one of the problems here is that the tensor model can only describe the geometry in terms of this ellipsoidal kind of quadratic framework. Is it possible to actually resolve this kind of subvoxel fiber crossing with diffusion MRI? And so that led to a technique called diffusion spectrum imaging, which we've described recently. So this is a coronal view through the brain. And what you notice is that here you have the cortical spinal tract, and where it intersects these transpontine fibers, you have this sort of orientational decoherence that's not consistent with the fiber anatomy. Whereas on DSI, you can resolve, so this is ROI from this particular brainstem, you can see both the ascending cortical spinal tract as well as these lateral transpontine fibers. So with this technique where we actually abandon the quadratic framework and measure the diffusion structure empirically, we can resolve that kind of composite intervoxel structure. So I thought this technique might be of interest to this audience because it involves, it's going to ultimately involve some interesting tomographic inversions. So the way that the diffusion function can be reconstructed without assuming a tensor framework is by Fourier transform, you can actually measure the diffusion probability function or the diffusion Green's function. If you then radially project over the radial coordinate of the diffusion function, the so-called X-ray transform, you can obtain the diffusion orientation distribution function. And so these glyphs that we showed earlier represent the orientational distribution of diffusion within each voxel. And so the tensor framework would apply a Gaussian fit to the raw Fourier data to describe the diffusion in terms of a single Gaussian structure. Whereas if you measure the diffusion function empirically, you can actually resolve this kind of composite structure. So that's interesting. So here, in the sagittal view, you have the cortical spinal tract and then these red transpontine fibers coming out of the plane of the screen. And so in that individual voxel, we can resolve both of those constituent fiber populations. And so the idea here is that we're measuring the underlying diffusion function and then examining its orientational structure using the X-ray transform on the diffusion Green's function, which we show here. So this is the, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So in the voxel, I have a 3x3 matrix. That's the diffusion tensor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I have in my box.
Mm-hmm.
So now what do I do to create this?
Right. So what you actually have, what we're claiming is that the underlying diffusion is not really Gaussian. So that a Gaussian model described by a diffusion tensor glosses over the actual underlying structure. In reality, you actually have composite diffusion because the neural architecture is much more complex at the voxel scale. You can imagine the fibers crossing and interdigitating and fanning and bending within a voxel. So if a typical voxel is a millimeter, that's a kilometer as far as neural architecture is concerned. So you have this composite architecture. And then if you apply a Gaussian framework and try to describe that composite diffusion by a single quadratic structure, you're not going to capture that kind of orientational heterogeneity. But if you measure the diffusion function empirically, so you abandon the assumption of Gaussian diffusion and measure the diffusion function empirically, and it might be Gaussian and it might not. It turns out that it's not because of the sort of composite architecture.
But fundamentally, the measurement that voxel is at best, if you do all the directions and nothing changes, is still a 3x3.
No. Yeah, so perhaps that point.
True.
Yeah.
Let's forget about whether it's Gaussian or not Gaussian. You know, it's a 9-valued image. At each voxel, I have 9 values.
That's no, that's not true. So perhaps I didn't explain that clearly enough. So the actual acquisition is a 3-dimensional Cartesian grid in Fourier space. So we're no longer simply taking 9 measurements and reconstructing the diffusion tensor. Rather, we're sampling over a 3-dimensional Cartesian grid. So for 10 directions on the side, we have 1,000 samples as opposed to simply 9 samples. And for it, so this these panels here schematically represent slices through that acquisition volume. So we typically take it, and so then by Fourier transform, you can measure the diffusion Green's function directly. So as that point just suggests, the problem with that technique is that it's extremely inefficient, because now in order to reconstruct the diffusion function, we have to take on the order of 1,000 measurements. So this would require 3-4 hours on a scanner. So that image that I just showed previously was the result of a 4-hour scan. But what occurred to us, and the sort of the challenge was, we're primarily interested in the orientational structure. The three-dimensional Cartesian diffusion function is very interesting, but what captures the salient architecture of the tissue is simply the orientational contrast, the fact that I have increased diffusion probability in this direction versus that direction. So if we analyze the data in terms of these ODFs, is there a technique that will let us measure the ODFs directly? So the idea is that the underlying diffusion Green's function is very informative, but we can also capture the orientational structure of the tissue simply by looking at the ODF, the orientation distribution function, which is simply the radial projection of the Cartesian diffusion function. So that posed an interesting sort of reconstruction problem for us, which is that we measure the diffusion signal in Fourier space, and by Fourier transform we can get the diffusion function. And then by the X-ray transform, we're projecting over the radial coordinate, we can obtain the amount of diffusion, the diffusion probability over a sphere. But what we wondered is there a way to sample on a spherical surface in Fourier space and obtain the ODF? And it turned out that the answer to that was a transform called the Funk-Radon transform, also known as the spherical Radon transform. So the idea here is there's a Fourier relationship between the diffusion signal and the diffusion function, but I'm primarily interested in the spherical projection of the diffusion function. So the diffusion function projected onto the sphere, how can I obtain that from a spherical acquisition in Fourier space? So you need something like the Fourier transform on the sphere, which turned out to be the Funk-Radon transform. And the resulting technique is something we call Q-ball imaging, because the Fourier space is Q, and it's kind of like a ball, so it's Q-ball imaging. So the Funk-Radon transform is somewhat arcane, but it simply entails summing over the equator in Fourier space. So if I have this spherical acquisition, all I need to do, and this is the surprising result, all I need to do is sum over an equator. Let's see if I can draw that. An equator of that acquisition in order to obtain the ODF. So I can illustrate that schematically as follows. So if I have some geodesated sampling scheme in Fourier space, if I want to evaluate the amount of diffusion in a particular direction, all I have to do is add the Fourier space signal over the corresponding equator. And we'll offer a proof sketch in the following slide. But what this basically says is that the sum over a circle in Fourier space gives you something approximately equal to the radial projection normal to the plane of that equator in the real space. So in real space, if I want to find out how much stuff is going in that direction, in Fourier space, all I need to do is add up the Fourier signal over the corresponding circle that has that direction as the normal vector. So that's kind of neat. And here's a proof. I don't know whether or not to actually walk through it. But the idea is that basically, from Plancherov's theorem, maybe I'll skip it, and I can talk about it later if anyone's interested. But I can offer an intuitive kind of heuristic proof. So if we just consider the case of Gaussian diffusion, where we have a tensor. So imagine in real space, I have this prolate sort of sausage-shaped tensor. In the Fourier space, that's going to be like a pancake, because it's the matrix inverse of the diffusion tensor. So it's going to be like a pancake in the real space, the direction of the diffusion is going to be normal to the plane of that pancake. So in real space, I have a prolate diffusion, and in Fourier space, I have oblate diffusion that's in the plane normal to that. It has a normal plane to that vector. So that if I sum over a circle, I'm going to capture the signal in Fourier space when I am aligned with the plane of that pancake, which tells me that there is enhanced diffusion along the plane normal to that equatorial plane. So here we just show this schematically. So summing over an equator in the Fourier space defines something like a radial projection normal to the plane of that circle. It's not the radial projection exactly, but actually it falls off like a zeroth order Bessel function. So that's why you have these rings. But to the extent that the mass of the zeroth order Bessel function is concentrated at the origin, that gives you something like the true radial projection. So what's neat about that technique is that now we have a way to go from Fourier space to real space completely on the sphere. And there's a subtlety here. There's a numerical subtlety, which is that typically when we sample on a sphere, we have to sample over some geodesated polyhedron. So we need to regrid the data onto a set of equators. So we accomplish that using a spherical radial basis function interpolation. And actually, when all the dust settles, this gives us a linear relationship between the ODF and the signal. So here's a reconstruction matrix that will show you how to go from a five-fold tessellated icosahedron in Fourier space to a seven-fold tessellated dodecahedron in real space. So there really is a linear transformation that can take you from the signal to the actual ODF, all in spherical coordinates, or all in these sort of geodesated polyhedral coordinates. So here's a diffusion tensor image. This is a coronal cut through the brain like such. And so just to point out some anatomy here, so you have these corpus callosal fibers, which connect the two hemispheres of the brain. So that's like this projection here. And then you have these ascending coronoradiata fibers. And so this is under the diffusion tensor framework, where these individual glyphs just show the principal eigenvector of the diffusion tensor at every voxel location. So I can only describe a single fiber direction at every voxel location. Using the cue ball technique, you can actually resolve the fiber crossing architecture. So you can actually see the fanning projections from the corpus callosum to these individual gyri. Right. So you have all this fiber crossing architecture that is ignored under the diffusion tensor model, where you can only describe a single fiber direction in terms of the principal eigenvector of the diffusion tensor. But here, when you actually measure the spherical diffusion probability directly, you can resolve all of this exquisite fiber crossing architecture. So like here, for example, where we have these three-way intersections, we have these projections here to the postcentral gyrus. You have these ascending fibers from the coronoradiata, and then you also have these kind of drab green fibers projecting through plane from the cingulum. So you can really resolve these higher order crossings if you measure the diffusion function directly. And you know, there's an interesting point here, which is that when you know about this, and then you look at a diffusion tensor image, you can start to see some of the paradoxes. So like here, for example, in this lobe of cingulate gyrus, where is this area getting inputs from? Or also here, like where is this area getting inputs from? It doesn't seem like there are any actual fibers projecting to this region, which is topologically unsound because they have to receive neural projections from somewhere. But when you actually look at the fiber crossing architecture, you can see that they receive projections laterally. Right? So here this looks isolated from a connectivity standpoint, but here you can actually see that it's receiving input from these other, and similarly here you can see that it's receiving input from the other regions. So we think this provides a more complete picture of the connectivity architecture as well. So just to zoom up with that, we can see these three-way crossings. And we see a similar fiber architecture. This is in the macaque monkey, where we can also see this fiber pattern where we have the ascending coronoradiata and these striations from the corpus callosum, as well as the cingulum fibers, these green fibers projecting through plane. So it really is a way to get much, much more complex anatomy than you ever could hope to get under diffusion tensor imaging. And what's interesting is that in addition to deep white matter crossings, we can also see these insertions to the gyral wall. So we see this complex architecture right at the gyral wall, where you have the white matter fibers inserting to the gyral wall. So we think that these crossing fibers actually represent the insertions to the gyres. So I'll conclude here by saying that cue ball imaging using the Funk Radon transform provides a linear model-independent reconstruction for diffusion imaging on the sphere. That's an important contrast, which I didn't make earlier, which is that diffusion tensor imaging is fundamentally model-based. It assumes Gaussian diffusion. But here, if you abandon the assumption of Gaussian diffusion and measure the diffusion spherical probability function directly, you can resolve much more complex architecture than you could under the model approach. So we can resolve fiber crossing and deep white matter, as well as insertions to the gyral wall. and it essentially extends diffusion imaging to describe much more complex structure than had previously been thought possible with diffusion imaging. So perhaps I'll conclude there. There's a funny endnote, which is I should acknowledge my collaborators, in particular Wim van Duffel, who helped a lot with the monkey acquisitions. I should also say, if anyone wants to contact me, if you're in Boston and you want to see the shop, please feel free to email me. But there's a funny endnote, which is that the Funk transform is so esoteric that if you do a Google search for Funk transform, the first or second hit you get is, I love watching the Funk transform the room into a wild party. So, so perhaps I'll conclude there. Thanks.
We have time for one question, and then we'll torture you at dinner.
Okay.
All right, I'll ask one.
Yeah, please.
Before we can go eat. There's so many things here. How were you doing the reconstructions in the of the current source? What was the data? Was it EEG?
This was EEG. I just received part of my ignorance on the rabbit experiments is because I just received those data a few days ago. I believe it was 40 electrode EEG.
Okay. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
That was a great time.